Columbus has trusted Atlas Butler for heating and cooling since 1921. They didn't start out doing plumbing because home plumbing wasn't really a thing yet. Yeah, they've been around a while. Call 1-800-FURNACE. Atlas Butler has convenient 2-hour service windows for heating, cooling, and plumbing service. Because nobody likes waiting around. You listening, BMB? Nobody likes waiting around. Call
1-800-FURNACE. Hello, Toasters. Welcome along to a cheeky little bonus episode. Today's episode is called My Mate Bought a House. Now, this is something I've wanted to do for quite a while. Normally, we interview comedians and actors and all sorts of showbiz types about their life history. I wanted to ask someone whose literal job it is to be good at money what their Amazon purchase history looks like, right? This is something I wanted to do for ages, to literally take someone and put their mouth where their money has been, if that makes sense and doesn't sound too mucky. So my guest today is a fascinating guy. He's called Brian Burns. He is head of personal finance at Moneybox. And yeah, you know, a financial advisor, you might think it's all going to get a little bit dry as toast. Not the case. Did you take the cat for a walk during lockdown?
Yep.
Yeah. I love it. You could bury your head in a dolphin mask. That's something we'll you've done here in March 2019.
We'll come on to that.
You've bought the swan masquerade costume.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to buy less Dwight Schrute reversible pillows next month.
It's just a mug covered in Keir Starmer's face.
Yeah.
It's all very good stuff. So today's episode, My Mate Bought a House, begins now. Oh, when I need a laugh, there's a helping people. But don't pass talking to this funny. Asking what they're buying and they're telling stories. Can somebody yell out the name of the show, please? It's my mate, what a toaster. Oh, it's my mate, what a toaster. Yeah, yeah, it's my mate, what a toaster. Oh, toast of all my love, thank God, toaster. Hello, welcome along to another episode of My Mate Bought a Toaster. This is the show where we tell someone's life story by diving into their shopping history. Now, we have done over 100 of these shows, and every time there are various themes that come out. Often people might feel a little bit shopping shamed, and they might feel like their finances are a little bit out of control. So there's this idea that's been brewing in my head for a while now, to get someone on who isn't necessarily a comedian, who isn't necessarily an actor, but is someone who literally is professionally good with money. I wanted to see what would happen if I dived into the purchase history of an actual finance expert to find out how they spent their money. Would we all feel better about how we spend our money, or are we going to discover he only buys really sensible things like paperclips and money boxes? Talking of money boxes, I'm very pleased to welcome to today's show Brian Burns, head of personal finance at Moneybox. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me. What an intro.
Well, you're welcome. I'm very, very excited to do this. This is a big experiment because I'm really hoping that your shopping history is as wild and crazy as everyone else's, so we all feel a bit better.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of boring stuff in there, I'll be perfectly
honest.
Solid.
Good, love that. Yeah.
But hopefully there's some wild stuff in there as well.
Okay,
to make
great.
People feel better.
Okay, good. Right, so we're going to dive in, right? I'm just going to go straight back
and
find out exactly what's going on with you. And we're going back to 2014, right? That's when we find your first purchase. And it makes sense for a financial advisor to buy this, to be honest. It makes perfect sense. You've bought the swan masquerade costume.
Yeah. Yeah.
Swan costume. Is this how you do maths? You like to
basically
dance?
We'll start this off by completely haunting your listeners. Halloween costume. It was around the time, I don't know if it was when Black Swan actually came out or if it was a couple of years later.
Yes, Natalie Portman film, is that right?
Exactly, yeah. And I would just say I looked exactly like Natalie Portman in that costume.
I don't know why I laughed at that. I'm probably, sorry for laughing, Brian. I can imagine you made a wonderful Natalie Portman. Yeah.
I mean, for some reason, I thought Halloween that year that Black Swan was a good costume.
Excellent.
So had the full gear, had the tights, had the makeup, went to a house party. The house was the temperature of the sun, so the makeup that I had on just like started melting and coming off. And the photos back, which I haven't shared with you because they would genuinely be career ending, are absolutely haunting. So yeah, that's a good start. That is not a financial advisor purchase by any stretch.
To be honest, I'd have been really sad if it was like a calculator.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That would have been too cliche. You know, this is proving that financial advisors, you know, have lives and have have dripping makeup just like the rest of us.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. No, going back, yeah, that far, what, 10 years ago? Yeah.
Yeah.
I was absolutely shocking with money at that point. So nobody should be in any way ashamed or embarrassed by their online purchases.
Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So would you say to people, I'm terrible with my own, whilst being a financial advisor yourself?
Probably wouldn't necessarily say that to my clients time.
Yeah.
So I started off my career working in what's called like high net worth. So helping people invest like substantial sums of money.
I'm going to have numbers here.
Similar to like £1 million plus, multi-million pound kind of portfolios.
So, okay, so hang on, stop you there. So you're saying to people, right, I reckon you should put £1 million in this car company called Tesla, for example, right? Is that the sort of thing you do or is it different?
It's the same. We're getting a little bit boring about it now, but diversified portfolios, all that sort of stuff. Not individual companies, not necessarily Tesla.
Okay.
I would absolutely be advising customers on what they should do to invest their money to beat inflation, all this sort of stuff. Yeah. While simultaneously at that time, being in my mid-20s, being absolutely terrible with my own money. So there was a massive separation between professional and personal money management at that time, which I think is fine. I've gotten better with it over the years, kind of thankfully. But yeah, in my early 20s, I had just moved to London from Dublin. So I was more focused on having a good time with money rather than saving and investing for the future.
So you weren't necessarily saving much at all at this stage?
No.
Oh, that's good to hear.
It was quite interesting at that time. You would go and you would advise these extremely rich clients, and they will kind of think that you're in the same boat as they are in terms of earnings and wealth and all that sort of stuff. And you'd be like, no.
Well, then they see a little bit of makeup on the back of your neck. You'd be like, oh, no, it doesn't matter.
I lived in Clapham, as every Irish person does when they moved over. And then actually I moved to Fulham, and I was speaking to a client who lived in the same area. And he was like, oh, do you live in Fulham, kind of Battersea, because of the proximity to the helipad? It's really handy, isn't it? I was like, I get the bus to work. Yeah, very, very big difference, separation between professional and personal life at that time.
Were there big mistakes that you made? What were your big learnings, like professionally? Were there big times where you put big chunks of money in the wrong place? And what do you do when that money's been lost? And, you know, do you still think of that stuff now? And did you learn a lot from that sort of stuff?
So I don't want to lose you too many listeners at this point, but the main mistake that I made in my 20s, I paid absolutely no attention whatsoever to my pension, like zero, none. I just didn't really feel like I had the disposable income at that point.
And but also people feel like if you're in your 20s, the idea of saving for your pension, I'm in my 40s and I still now feel like, oh, I'm never really going to be 60 or 70 anyway. Yeah. Like it is a fictional character.
Yeah.
Your future self is a fictional character.
Yeah. And there's so much studies to say that it's next to impossible to relate to that fictional character that is so far away because like with everything that we do in life, I think we change kind of every 10 years, basically. You're a completely different person when you're 30 compared to 20, when you're 40 compared to 30. Mm. If you extrapolate that out like 4 or 5 decades, you're a completely different person at that point. So I'm not in any way kind of, well, being too self-critical or harsh on myself, I don't think people in their 20s should spend huge amounts of time on their pension. But the thing that I would say to people is that your employer, if you're in traditional salaried employment, your employer pays into your pension as well. And the thing that I wish that I'd done at that point is just get the most out of my employer to pay into my pension as you possibly can.
When you say get the most out of it, because a lot of people probably just do the automatic default thing, right?
Yeah.
And just put X in. So when you say get the most out of it, do you mean crank it up a bit?
Well, every employer would be slightly different. Some of them are really, really generous. Some of them not quite so much.
Yeah.
So if, for example, you're putting in 4% and they're putting in 4%, some employers will say, okay, if you up yours by 1%, then we'll do ours as well.
Yeah.
And then you can get up to the maximum that they will put in if it's affordable for you. And that is genuinely free money into your pension.
But a lot of people will be at that point where they've got a job in their 20s and the employer goes, right, this is the percentage you should put into your pension. And very few people will go, I'm going to negotiate with that. I'm going to go up on that. People will just go, thanks for the job.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And the thing that I kind of regret is I actually reduced mine at that time.
So again,
I'm telling you, this is the thing. I was chatting with someone about this the other day. People think that financial advisors or people in this space have always been perfect with money. And that if you're good with money, it's something that you're born with. You're born kind of differently to people.
Yes.
It's absolutely not the case. As I say, I was rubbish with money in my 20s. Thankfully, kind of professionally, I've had to learn more about it. And therefore, I've got gotten better with my money and my savings and my pensions and all that sort of stuff. Mm. People are not necessarily in the same position as me where dealing with money is your professional, it's your work, and people have other things to do in terms of like families, their jobs, and don't have as much time to spend on it when it's your actual job. But you can get better with money. It is not something that you either have or you don't. It's something that if you dedicate a little bit of time to, you will get significantly more confident with money.
Yes. Confidence is a big thing, isn't it? And it is like, it's like a sport, maybe. You know, I look at Formula One and just go, I know nothing about that.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it just takes 5 minutes. Just here are three headlines. And suddenly, oh, I'm into it a little bit. I'm into the plot. I'm into what's going on. And people just need to be, I guess, engaged is the slightly dry word around that. But people need to just take a little bit of action, tiny bit.
Yeah.
It can make a difference.
The confidence thing, just very quickly, is super interesting. We did a piece of research last year and we basically asked people everything about their money, everything about their savings, all that sort of stuff, everything about how much they were earning. And we also said, look, how confident are you with money?
Yes.
And the confidence point was the most important point in terms of how much money they ended up with at the end of the day.
Right.
So you would have some really high earners who were not confident with money and didn't have that much saved. You would have people that weren't earning quite so much, but they were really confident with money, and then they would end up with more at the end of the day than the people that were on really high salaries.
So they're punching.
Yeah, absolutely punching because they're confident with money. And the reason that they're confident with money is that they dedicate time to it. So exactly what you were saying there, 5 or 10 minutes a week, whatever it might be, has a massive impact on your net worth at the end of the day, more so than your salary, how much you're paid. That's obviously a factor, but the confidence is huge.
It's interesting though, isn't it? The drip feed factor. If you drip feed moderate amounts of money in over time, the benefits are massive. If you drip feed moderate amounts of time in as well, over time, the benefits are massive.
Absolutely.
It's really interesting. Okay, good. All right, look, moving on. 2015, Love Heart Raccoons personalized keyring. That's all I can see here. I mean, December 2015. Some sort of keyring about raccoons.
So I was in a flat share.
Right.
And there was four of us in the flat share.
Yeah.
And two of us were pretty clean and tidy and the other two were not.
Mm-hmm.
Myself and my friend who is the clean and tidy one alongside me, we badged the other two as raccoons because just the way that they lived and the rubbish that they would store and all that sort of stuff.
Love
so
that.
We basically named them the raccoons. So as a Christmas present for her, as a kind of inside joke, I got her a key ring saying, I heart raccoons.
Okay, great.
We
perfect.
Were constantly cleaning up after the other two. Lovely people, but unbelievably messy.
But again, very, very relatable because we've all been in those flat share situations with the mess. And this leads us neatly onto renting as well. Is this a flat share, I assume, where you're renting at this point? So rent is the big sort of money problem that sits across an entire generation, isn't it? It's I think, obscene how much money people are having to spend on rent, how much the deposits are, all that sort of stuff. Back then for you, this is what, 2015?
Yeah.
Still tricky, not easy then, but nowhere near like it is now.
No. First-time buyers at the moment are facing hardest buying conditions in 70 years. So that's a combination of interest rates. So the amount you pay on your mortgage, if you ever actually get the opportunity to buy, rental conditions, how difficult it is to get a deposit together. So yeah, it was tough in 2015, but over the last 10 years, it's got even tougher.
Yeah. Okay. So people have got to tidy up their finances. Like, you know, they can't be messy raccoons when it comes to money.
No. But the thing that I say, and I say to our customers a lot, it is still possible. We see tens of thousands of people per year, first time buyers, getting onto the property ladder, and they are from all sorts of backgrounds, demographics, income amounts.
Because all I can hear now is people going, it's just bank of mum and dad. You just wait. You know, we know that. Is it someone told me that bank of mum and dad is like the sixth biggest mortgage provider in the country? Like it's crazy. And then that just means it's inherited wealth, and it means the people who are middle class or whatever who've got those chunks of money can carry on being on the property ladder.
Yeah.
And if you don't, it's so rigged against people.
But I think the perception is, and look, bank of mum and dad is absolutely a big factor. And as you say, it just kind of passes down generational wealth. But lots of people still get onto the property ladder without bank of mum and dad. And that's the point that we try and make as well, because the perception can be out there is that everybody gets help from bank of mum and dad. And some people do, and some people don't. Some people save for a couple of years to get their deposit together. We see people saving for 10 years plus to get their deposit together. There is an incredibly wide range of demographics and experiences getting onto the property ladder. So it is tough, but it is not just for people who have support from bank of mum and dad. It is still possible, kind of regardless of your background. background. But it's tough. It takes time. It takes a lot of discipline with your finances, which is not necessarily the most kind of fun thing in the world. Yeah. Everybody would prefer to be out buying raccoon key rings and costumes. Yeah. And sounds weird, but there should still be a place for that kind of fun stuff in every budget as well.
Yeah.
Like, people think of budgets should be super restrictive.
You hear the word budget and you just think, well, that's the opposite of fun.
Exactly, basically. But every budget has to have room for whatever is fun in your life, be it kind of costumes or just going out at the weekend, going on holiday, all that sort of stuff. Because if you are going to be saving for a deposit for 6, 7, 8 years, you can't live like a monk for that entire period. You have to enjoy yourself.
Of course.
Or else you will do it for 6 months and then you'll just give up because you're not enjoying yourself along the way.
So you at this stage, right, 2015, you're a financial, what are you, a financial advisor at this point? What's the lifestyle like? You're in a house share. Are you working crazy hours? Is there this sort of cliched London city thing going on? Tell me about you at this point.
No, I wouldn't say I've ever been particularly kind of cliche London city. I remember I met my wife a couple of years after this and she thought, I don't know if I gave her the impression or what it was, but she thought I was an investment banker.
What does that mean? So what's the difference?
That's the mega money. That's the ridiculously long hours. That's the kind of shows that you see where they're working 20 hours and then they're going out to clubs and doing all sorts of stuff and paid ridiculous amounts. Yeah. Financial advisor is definitely not that side of things.
Okay.
And yeah, she thought I was on that side of the equation.
Is that because you led her to believe that in order to be interested in
you? We debate that to this day. we debate that to this day, but... as I say, the financial advice side of things is nowhere near as lucrative. It's also nowhere near as ridiculous when the kind of hours, the hours that you work. So it was a pretty good balance. And as I say, living in a flat share, we were in Fulham at that time. It was very much working pretty hard during the week, but very much enjoying the weekends as well.
Did you ever find yourself out and about? Does this still happen where, you know, the worst thing I can hear as a stand-up is when someone says on a night out, go and tell us a joke. That just makes me want to literally headbutt a wall. Do people sort of corner you at parties and go, so where should I be doing ices now?
Yeah.
That must drive you mad.
Yeah, well, a little bit. But I quite like in a way that people are actually talking about money because it is one of the last taboos in our culture that people just do not talk about money. Don't talk about savings. Don't talk about investments. I wouldn't even say it's irritating, but the people are often just looking for how do I double my money in a year? And the thing that you actually tell them is significantly more boring, but more lucrative over time. And it's exactly what you said about dedicating money to your finances. The thing in this country, because we don't have a culture of financial education, we don't have a culture of investing, all that sort of stuff, the easiest thing when it comes to your money is just to bury your head in the sand. That's what you find a lot of the time.
By the way, you could bury your head in a dolphin mask. That's something you've done here in March 2019.
We'll come on to that. The easiest thing to do is absolutely bury your head in the sand. It's not the most exciting thing to do to sort out your savings, your investing, your pensions, all that sort of stuff. But instead of giving people a stock market tip, I just say, look, 30 minutes every weekend, just dedicate it to your money. Yeah. If there's terms within the financial landscape, like an ISA or a pension or whatever it might be, that you don't understand, spend your time that weekend figuring out what that word is and building up your confidence. Spend your time listening to a podcast, whatever it might be. So yeah, people do ask me those types of questions and I think they're sometimes disappointed that I don't say, oh, you put your money into this stock or this crypto coin or whatever.
Oh my God.
It might be.
That's the worst thing is to go home and go, I met this guy at a party.
Yeah.
I'm putting all of our savings into crypto. Yeah. So he said it's great.
We like to listen to toast and we're not the kind who would boast. And even in spite of the host, we still like to listen to toast. La la la.
Let's talk about the lifetime ISA, right? So the Lisa, that came along just before lockdown, so like 2019. And this is a really, really important tool. And again, this is something which, the way I learned about it is a perfect example of, I think, how financial advice works in this country. Conversation, connection with people. If I'd sat down and seen an article in a newspaper about it, I'd literally have looked straight through it and gone, huh, I would never have thought that's for me.
Yeah.
It's a friend of mine, Beanie, shout out Beanie, thank you for this, who sat me down and went, this exists. If you're going to save for a pension, just do this. So that for me was for a pension, but for a lot of people, obviously it's for first time buyers. So talk to me about the lifetime ISA because it's a really, really important product.
Absolutely. So it's a government incentivized saving and investing product, basically. And you can put in up to £4,000 a year and the government will top that up by 25%. So you can get
that's £1,000 a year the government are giving you.
Exactly. So a maximum £1,000. You can team up with somebody else. So if you're buying a house together, you can both get the government bonus.
Right.
And you can use the lifetime ISA for two purposes. One is getting onto the property ladder, so purchasing your first home. And then the other one is supplementing your retirement savings. So it's an incredibly important product. It has helped about 250,000 people onto the property ladder so far.
That's amazing.
And it's helping about 60,000 first-time buyers every single year get onto the property ladder. So there is help out there, and the Lifetime ISA is a perfect example of that.
Yeah. So loads of people are going for this thing. It's a real, and you've got to do it before you're 40, haven't you? That's important.
Yeah, there's a couple of points to note about it. You have to have it open by your 40th birthday, but you can just stick a pound in, and then it can stay open. And if you want to use it at some stage in the future, you can do.
Yeah.
On the first time buyer side of things, the maximum house price you can purchase with the Lifetime ISA is £450,000, which in most parts of the country is still hell of a lot of house.
Yes.
There are some parts of London where that is becoming challenging. And actually, I was talking to some aspiring first-time buyers last week, and they were saying, it's not just the case that house prices have gone up since the Lifetime ISA was introduced. People's life plans have changed.
Yeah.
So people, as I say, speaking to last week, they're like, when I first started saving, I was single. I thought I'd just buy a one-bedroom flat in London, whatever it might be. And you can typically get one of those still today for less than £450,000.
Suddenly 5-6 years later, they're shacked up, there's kids.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they're not kind of looking to buy the same houses. So one of the things that I've been campaigning for with this government for a while is to try and get that house price increase. So fingers crossed they actually listen potentially this year.
Yes.
The other point to note is there's a withdrawal penalty if you use the Lifetime ISA money for anything other than those purchases, so buying your first home or retirement. Mm-hmm. There's a withdrawal penalty of 25%. So it's
take their money back, basically.
Yeah, plus a little bit more, which again is a big kind of irritation.
Yeah.
So it's an extremely good product for those two purposes. You just want to be very sure that that's what you're going to be using your money for, and then try and get as much government bonus as you possibly can.
Okay, this is really interesting. So the sort of threads we've got here is looking into your fictional future and looking after that fictional future, but also, here we are, Brian, looking at your factual past, right? We're going through the things you've bought, and we have got another costume here where you put your head in a dolphin's head. Superb work. Also, 7th of June 2020, so lockdown, you've got a cat harness and leash.
Yeah.
Did you take the cat for a walk during lockdown?
Yep.
I love it.
Yeah, so the cat's an interesting story. So the cat was a lockdown rescue.
Right.
Got it for my wife's birthday, which was in lockdown. She absolutely loved pets. We both do. Mm-hmm. So basically, there was a cat cafe around the corner from us.
Oh, these cat cafes are amazing.
Yeah. And I messaged them in lockdown because you've time in your hands. You're like, if you want anybody to look after the cats while it's lockdown, we're happy to do that. And instantly they were like, no. And then they messaged a couple of weeks afterwards and they were like, oh, this cat has just been like dumped on our doorstep. Basically, would you be happy to look after it for for the lockdown period? So we were like, yeah, absolutely. And it was kind of nominally, it was my wife's birthday, as I say. This cat hates my wife. Like passionately hates.
Is that why you love the cat? Is that what's going on?
And
here?
The cat, like, it's basically imprinted on me, I think, because I rescued it.
Right.
So absolutely adores me, cannot stand my wife.
She's a competitor to the Brian Love.
Basically, to this day.
Oh, wow.
And then, yes, again, in lockdown, we were like, oh, we were in a flat. We had no garden, and we did a kind of staycation thing just to a house with a garden when you're actually allowed to move about.
Yeah.
We're like, oh, it'd be nice to take the cat outside because it had never been outside. So yeah, we got the cat harness thing. But the cat just forgot how to do anything when the harness was on. And this is when you put it on, it basically just kind of fell over.
Well, it looks at you like, I'm not a dog.
Yeah.
Why are you putting this on me?
The way that it moved, it just completely forgot how to walk. And then just, as I say, fell flat on its side. So it was a very short walk, but a very distinct lockdown purchase.
And you still have the cat now?
Still have the cat now, yeah.
Okay.
We were lucky to be able to buy a house towards the end of lockdown.
You getting on the property ladder, or did you have a flat before?
No, that was us. That was us getting onto the property ladder.
Okay, so again, this is really interesting. You're a financial advisor, and you got on the property ladder. How old were you?
Early 30s.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So again, there's this big gap. There's this big gap in perception.
Absolutely.
Where people will look at you and go, well, he's probably just had a big chunk of money and he's done all the right things because he's a nerd since he was 20 and he's a millionaire. It's not the case.
No, absolutely not. And we were in London at the time. We were in a small kind of one bed flat and we started looking around London and we couldn't swing the cat that we had in the places that we could afford.
Is that what you used the leash for? To check how big the flat was?
Yeah. Be careful. I have the cat taken off me now by cat protection. But we moved down to Brighton just to be able to get a little bit more for our money. And we have a garden down there, so the cat doesn't need the leash anymore. Still hates my wife.
I love that. It has made new areas quite cool, right? Because younger people have moved out there. So it is no longer as it used to be. Certainly when I was in my 20s, the idea of moving out to certain parts was a bit like, oh, it's not as fun. But also it's part of not sort of resolutely digging your heels in and going, well, I can't buy here, so I'm just going to have to rent for the rest of my life. There is a moment where you have to go, look, it's annoying, I'm going to have to compromise. But with that compromise, I will get this stuff.
Yeah, and that's part of the kind of job that I try and do with our customers and then just going out and speaking to anybody that will listen, because a lot of the headlines around trying to get onto the property ladder convince you that you will be renting for life.
It's just give it, don't bother. That's exactly what everyone feels like. It's a bit like, you know what? Financial advice needs its couch to 5K moment, because what that has done for the literal movement of people, of going, I'm fat, I'm unfit, I'm not going to go running. Oh, couch to 5K. Oh, do you know what? I'm going to do the thing where you just do 100 yards. Financial stuff needs that moment where people start to go, stop giving up entirely, stop being negative and try.
And it's nobody's fault. Like when you, if they find themselves being negative about any financial stuff or including getting on the property ladder, because all of the headlines that we see day to day, like why would you be optimistic? Mm. And actually, this is why we go out and try and tell that positive story. We have the largest community of aspiring first-time buyers in the UK. We see people getting onto the property ladder absolutely day in, day out, hitting that crucial first kind of life goal. Mm. And we just go out and try and tell that story as much as possible just to try and combat all of the negative headlines that are out there.
Yeah.
And the issue with those negative headlines is it does make people feel like it's hopeless and that the best thing to do is to give up. So we're just trying to combat that. As I say, it's tough to be optimistic, but if you show people that it is still possible, it is still happening for people, hopefully people will be less likely to give up.
Personally, what's your biggest kick professionally? What do you get out of stuff when you achieve these things? Is it watching your clients get on the housing market?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a little bit of everything, because the weird thing, like when people say to me, oh, should I get into financial advice as a career? Like I say, there's a professionally, I think it's an absolutely brilliant career, but selfishly, like personally, it has made me so much more confident about my finances.
Yeah.
And you going back to the question of people asking you down the pub, I absolutely love those conversations and just trying to get rid, what I say about the best part of my job is trying to get rid of that nagging doubt that we all have about money.
Yes.
So when you're going to bed at night, just being like, oh, I really need to do something with that savings account, or I really need to start investing, or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
If I can get rid of that for one person every day, that is the best thing about my job.
Erasing the question marks.
Yeah. As much as you possibly can do.
Yeah. I love that. Okay, great. All right, let's power on through. So 2020, it's a standard lockdown vibe I'm seeing here on your Amazon purchase history, by the way. Do you ever worry about it? I mean, we're in 2020 here now, you're buying loads of stuff. As a financial advisor, do you ever have moments where you go, God, I'm spending quite a lot of money. For example, why have I bought the Dwight Schrute reversible face sequin pillow? Obviously, Dwight from The Office.
Yeah.
You know, do you have moments where you're like, oh, I'm spending too much money?
Yeah, definitely. But I kind of do what's called almost reverse budgeting. So,
oh, go on.
Ooh. Yeah. Ooh, yeah. So first day of the month, I will pay all my bills.
Yes.
I'll put my money into my savings account, and then anything that's left in my account is mine to spend for the month.
Love that.
Anything ridiculous or non-ridiculous that I would like. So,
what happens if you run out that month?
Hmm?
What happens if you run out that month?
Out that month and you need to dip into your savings or dip into your overdraft, you're like, okay, I'm going to buy less Dwight Schrute reversible pillows next month.
Yes.
Last month would be a classic example. I don't know what it was, but it was an expensive month for us for whatever reason. And when I looked at my account at the end of the month, I was like, ooh, not that much left really at all.
Yeah.
So this month going into April, I'm like, okay, need to be a little bit more sensible this month. But it's, if you pay yourself first, what's left is then yours to spend, and you don't need to feel guilty about whatever you're spending that on. It's the classic avocado toast thing.
That's just,
the nonsense that people are trying to be made feel guilty about what they're spending their money on. But as mentioned before, there has to be room for whatever it is that you're interested in, be it silly Amazon purchases or avocado toast. There has to be room for that in every budget. Yeah. And if you pay yourself first, hopefully you've got a bit of money left to spend on those sorts of things for the rest of the month.
And do you recommend getting like different bank accounts for that, or at least different, because I use Monzo quite a lot. So maybe I have little pots in Monzo and stuff. That way of sort of get payday comes and obviously I leave it for a day and go, oh, I've got money. And then I go, oh, and yeah. I need to do the things. And then I'm like, I've got no money. Do you recommend finding your, you know, put that in Monzo, put that in this account? Does that get messy or is that quite a good way of doing it?
As long as you don't have too many, then I think it's a good idea. So it's a good idea for a couple of reasons. One, you should shop around. We're actually getting a decent interest rate on savings now, which was never the case for like 10 years before the pandemic.
Can you get like?
You can get 4 or 5% pretty easily on your savings.
I'm still used to the days of 0.0001%.
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, you can get 4 or 5% pretty easily now.
You access those accounts?
Yeah, absolutely. Those are easy access savings accounts.
Okay.
So highly recommended that you shop around for those. The other point is like a little bit of what's called like positive friction. And that basically just means it's separate from your day-to-day spending account. So if you put it into a pot with whichever provider you might use. Excuse me. If you put it into a pot, whichever provider you might use, if it's slightly separate from your savings account, you're less tempted to dip into it at the weekend or on holiday, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
I referenced the Lifetime ISA side of things earlier in terms of the withdrawal penalty. We've been campaigning for that to be a little bit fairer so that you only lose the government bonus rather than lose any of your own money. People actually kind of like the withdrawal penalty in a weird way because it's something that's really important to them in terms of their deposit for their house. So they don't want to be able to dip into it. They don't want to have that temptation to dip into it, to go to the pub at the weekend or book a holiday or whatever it might be. So if you can recreate, for want of non-jargon, that kind of positive friction with your savings of just having it slightly separate and then shopping around and getting a decent interest rate on it, then it's a good thing to do.
It's the equivalent of leaving your mobile phone downstairs when you go to bed.
Yeah, no temptation.
It's a little bit harder to get to it.
Yeah.
Just put it down there.
Exactly.
Okay, good. If you'd done that, maybe you wouldn't have bought quite so much rubbish on Amazon.
Exactly.
Ooh, I don't want to hear no more crying. Just come on, let me know what you've been buying.
January 2023, girls just want to have funds.
Yeah.
That's a fantastic pun. A feminist guide to investing.
Yeah.
Talk to me. Oh, sorry. I just kicked you on the foot there. I just played footsie with you at the end of that.
Nice.
A feminist guide to investing. Talk to me about that.
You can see a bit of a progression in my Amazon purchases, getting slightly more mature and professional over the years and moving.
Yes, it's better than Dolphin's Head. Yes,
yeah,
you're right. Yes,
a little bit better for that.
Yeah.
That's an absolutely fantastic book that I would highly recommend to anybody. It is basically just highlighting the inequality between men and women's savings. And I think one of the first lines in the book, I'm going to absolutely butcher this now, but it's essentially saying there is no country on the planet where men and women are paid the same, effectively.
Crazy.
So that book is part of a movement. It's basically called Female Invest, and they do some absolutely incredible work. It's an online platform. It's an online community, as the name would suggest, particularly directed at women, helping educate them about the importance of saving, investing, and putting money into pensions. So I'd highly recommend that. And as I say, Amazon purchases getting a little bit more professional.
Yeah, we can see that they're marrying up with your professional life. It's encouraging. It's good to know you're growing up, Ryan. It's important. I'm interested in this idea of a feminist guide to investing. Obviously, we know that the pay gap, how bad is that now? Is that still insane?
Like, yeah.
And it improved?
It's improved ever so slightly, but it's not just a pay gap. It's a savings gap, it's an investing gap,
right,
and it's a retirement gap.
But why are those things the case as well? Just because women don't get paid as much?
Exactly, and they compound over time. So women are more likely to take gaps in their retirement in terms of kind of looking after the family, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
That obviously impacts how much you can save, how much you can invest, and particularly how much you can put into your pension. So the average amount that a woman ends up with in their pension compared to a man is very, very scary. So we need to do everything that we can do in terms of trying to close those gaps as much as possible. And those types of books are basically trying to break that taboo and have people talking to their colleagues, talking to their family, talking to their daughters, talking to their nieces, nephews, all that sort of stuff about money, and just trying to close those gaps as much as we can.
it must be hard for you when, because you are obviously you're very passionate about this stuff, and you are a, you know, part of your job is that you're a financial educator. You know, financial advisor is the word, is the phrase we all know. Financial educator is a really good way of thinking about it, because you've got this passion for stuff. But, you know, when I think about financial stuff I've done recently, my wife and I recently did our wills, and this is, I know it's slightly different, but we sat there for an hour and I could just see her just going, and I was the same, just like, I just can't engage with any of this stuff. How do we make these stories, and I hope today has done that to an extent, but how do we make these stories interesting, and how do you make people take action? Because as soon as you start talking about this stuff, people just go, again, it comes back to this thing. It's not real. It's not, yeah, it's fictional. You know, oh, it's too much for me to take on. How do you break these taboos and just make people take these little bits of action?
I think the really good thing about like today's world is there is so many different ways you can consume this information. I would say doing your wills, I think, will always probably be a bit dull.
Oh my God.
Always a little bit dull.
It's the worst. And also it's really depressing.
Yes, it is.
You get in the post, document arrives, it's my last will and testament. I'm 44. It was really, really awful. But you know what? It's, and no offense to what you do, is how I feel about financial advice as well. Yeah. It's the same thing where I just go, I just want to think about going and buying a nice coffee and what I'm doing this weekend. It just, people are head in the sand about this, yeah, stuff.
But the counter to that slightly now, I think more when it comes to do with saving, investing, day-to-day kind of personal finance, there are so many, they're called finfluencers out there, but they are people who are out there who are as passionate as I am about these things and actually better at articulating and engaging with people about these sorts of topics. So whether it's podcasts, whether it's TikTok, Instagram, whatever it might be,
yeah,
however you want to consume information, whether it's, as I say, some of the books that are on my more recent Amazon purchase history,
yeah,
however you like to consume information, there are really engaging ways to learn about investing, for example.
Yeah.
You need to do a little bit of research to make sure like who you are listening to has somewhat kind of decent credentials and isn't just, yes, talking to you about here's how you double your money in the space of 6 months. So that can be a little bit of a challenge.
Yeah.
But there are so many really, really good financial educators, as you put it, out there, that kind of gives me a bit of hope for the future.
Mm.
And actually, the research that we've done, and we've seen it from some other people as well, people are engaging more with their finances today. People are investing more and starting younger. So there is a good bit of positive traction on some of this stuff.
The thing that always strikes me is that people think there is going to be a quick, immediate solution. Because in a day and age of, you know, like you say, get rich quick has always been forever and a day the thing that people, human beings, want that thing, yeah, don't they? But especially today, where, you know, I want to find the thing that's going to double my money overnight. I look on this TikTok or whatever. And I think you have to understand the slowness of the game, don't you?
Yeah. But then when the positive stuff does come along quicker than you think. So the couch, yeah, to 5K stuff is the perfect analogy. If you've ever done it, you go out for your first couple of runs, you feel absolutely terrible. You're like, what am I doing? I'm not a runner. This is atrocious. And if you stick with it, three or four runs, you get to a point where you're like, oh, that actually wasn't quite so bad.
Mm.
And then suddenly, after what might be 8 or 10 runs, you're like, oh, actually, I'm not quite looking forward to this, maybe. But I'm a runner now,
yes,
and I never thought I could be. And we get the exact same with people saving and investing as well. When it comes to the lifetime ISA stuff, we have so many quotes from people who said, I never thought I could be a saver. I never thought I could be an investor.
Yeah.
Then when people do purchase a house, I remember speaking with one guy who's like, I'm the first person in my family to have a mortgage. And he said that with such a tremendous sense of pride.
Wow.
And these are the sorts of things. It's called kind of compounding, again, trying to not use too much kind of jargon, but it's the same as the running stuff.
Mm.
If you get into these really good habits about saving, investing, educating yourself, suddenly it will become a case of 6-12 months down the line where you're like, oh, I'm actually better at this than I thought I was. And it's the same with the running.
Yeah. Okay, good. Look, last thing you bought, most recent item that I've got here, and this might ruin everything at the last minute. I don't know how people feel about this, man. You've bought a mug, which is the Keir Starmer collar. Yeah. It's just a mug covered in Keir Starmer's face.
Yeah.
So take us through, what is this? Is this ironic? Or is this what you're going to be drinking when you go and advise him and ask him to raise the threshold on those things?
You're not too far away there, actually. Okay. This is not me nailing my political colours to the wall. So I'm from Dublin originally. I came over to the UK. That means I don't really have a political creed here,
so
to speak, or a political party that I have any allegiance to, really. But one of the weird parts of my job over the course of the last couple of years has been going into government, going into Treasury, going into HMRC, advocating for policies that better support first-time buyers.
So who do you talk to when you go and do that?
Anyone that will listen, basically. Anyone that will listen. So going and speaking with individual MPs, going and speaking with senior civil service, going and speaking with civil servants in Treasury or HMRC, anybody that is responsible for things like the lifetime ISA, for example, kind of keep coming back to that.
Yeah.
And basically saying, look, these are our customers. This is the data that we hold. These are the things that are impacting them today. And here's what you can do to make their lives a little bit easier.
Yeah.
So that's, as I say, been the weird part of my job for the last couple of years.
Do they do stuff? Do they just listen and nod?
A bit of both. Okay. So you'll go in. I remember the first couple of meetings I went into. You'll go in, they would listen and nod, they would be very positive, and you think, oh, we're actually getting somewhere here, and then nothing would happen immediately.
Yes.
So the thing that I have learnt is that things move very slowly. Even stuff that is very, very logical, common sense, can take a while to get done. So I think on the lifetime ISA stuff, we are getting somewhere, hopefully this year, in terms of things like the house price cap, the withdrawal penalty.
Yeah.
But that has been 2.5 years of banging on doors, going have meetings for something that, in my view, is just perfect kind of common sense and really not that expensive for the government
to deliver. And how do you send those pushy emails going, be great to loop back on this again? Can I nudge you on this? Like, that's a really hard part of this job.
It is a hard part of this job. The politicians and civil servants have actually been really open to the story that we're telling them because they are kind of desperate for data, desperate for kind of real life data. And as I say, given we have largest community of aspiring first time buyers, they've been really interested in the story that we're telling. So it's been pretty positive, but very much a slow burn. And as I say, that mug was, I can't remember what time of year.
December.
It was. Yeah, exactly. It was a Christmas party thing where I was hosting this kind of quiz thing, and that was a ironic quiz prize. So as I say, not me nailing my political colours to the wall.
Yeah. Fair enough. Listen, we're running out of time. I'd love to hear your top line. Here's what I would do if I was say under 40, in my 20s and 30s. What is the financial advice, Brian, head of personal finance at Moneybox, that you would most love people to investigate?
It's probably a bit of self-investigation. Mm-hmm. So working out what your money is for, your financial goal. So a lot of people, and myself in my 20s, would just go day to day, week to week, month to month, year to year, just going paycheck to paycheck and not really considering why they're working, if they have the opportunity to save, what they're saving for.
Mm-hmm.
Working out that kind of financial goal part is absolutely crucial because after that, there's actually savings products that are out there to help you achieve that financial goal.
Yeah.
So when people turn up to Moneybox and open an account, whenever we ask them, look, why are you here? What are you saving for? Their primary financial goal at that point is getting onto the property ladder.
Yeah.
And we can say to them, we can educate them about the lifetime ISA and say, look, this is the thing where you can get £1,000 free from the government every year.
Mm.
Whether it's investing, there's a stocks and shares ISA that does a similar thing in terms of helping you to invest. If it's you just want to go on holiday, for example, there's different kind of savings accounts. So everything flows from that financial goal side of things.
So clarity about what you want to do with it.
Exactly. And just as I say, we are in no way through the cost of living crisis. It is still an incredibly difficult period for people with their money. But if you do have the opportunity to save, even if it's 50 quid a month, just trying to figure out what that money is for and what you're trying to achieve, things will get easier after that because there are lots of very good financial products out there to help you achieve those financial goals.
And just make sure you've always got money in your budget for costumes.
For costumes, exactly.
That's what we're seeing from your Amazon purchase history.
And cat leads,
Love it. Brian, head of personal finance at Moneybox, thank you so much for coming on the show. Go and get a Lisa, guys. That seems to be the headline here. Get a lifetime ISA if you can. Brian, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much to Brian for popping in and hopefully not ruining his personal and professional reputation too much by admitting to quite so many costumes. Quite extraordinary. I hope you enjoyed that app. I found it really interesting talking to Brian, and I hope for some of you it has begun the process of, as Brian was saying, breaking down taboos and just making you start to think in tiny increments about this stuff. Because trust me, I can't do it. I find it really hard. Literally, whilst researching this, I realized I haven't got a certain type of ISA, and I've oh God, it's, even now I'm like, ugh, and I've done it and I've sorted it out. So it has got some action. If it gets you doing some action, then that's really helpful. There's a link to Moneybox in the episode description. It's really, really interesting stuff. So head on there if you have more questions. We're back on Thursday with another episode. Helen Bauer is going to be my guest. Probably a little bit less financial advice in that episode, I'll be honest. In the meantime, have a great few days. See you Thursday. It's my mate.